Welcome to Aircrew Interview. I'm Mike Young, your host, and today's podcast is with Mike Napier. Mike is an ex-RAF Tornado GR1 pilot, and in this episode he talks about flying it in operations and other aspects of flying the aircraft. He also chats about being an author and flying the Hawk as an instructor. So please enjoy and don't forget to subscribe at youtube.com/aircrewinterview. So Michael, how did you become interested in aviation?
I've actually been interested in it as for as long as I can remember, actually. And it's a bit like saying, how long have you had your right leg or whatever it is. I think, as I said to you earlier on, every little boy wants to be a pilot or an engine driver, and most people then grow up and get a proper job, and I never did. But yeah, as far as I can remember, I've been completely obsessed by aeroplanes and flying. And I guess my first kind of realisation of that, I've got this memory, we lived in Aden in the mid-60s, was walking along a road with a huge great cardboard box that I just inherited for something. I was going to use it for, you know, to go take that to my mate's house. And I remember seeing these two hunters going whistling across from RAF Cormac. And I remember looking at it going, wow, that's amazing. And I think that's probably where the seed was planted. But it continued from there, really. So I've always just been obsessed with aeroplanes and flying, and that's all I've ever wanted to do. Sadly, probably shows I'm very unimaginative, really. There we go.
So what was your first aviation experience?
I guess it depends how you define that, really. But in terms of being a passenger on an aeroplane, I can remember being, again, probably back from somewhere like Aden, sitting in a VC-10 airliner coming back. But the first time I actually sat in an aeroplane kind of properly that one might fly was a Chipmunk Air Experience flight. And again, that was, I was a kind of 14-year-old, but quite a small 14-year-old, so I had this huge great parachute, which was twice as big as me, dangling from my bum, and I sort of lobbed into the back of this chipmunk, and off I went. And I kind of always assumed that aeroplanes would be lovely and smooth. This thing's a rattling old bus, and it was that thing of trying not to be sick as the guy flew you around, and you're sort of a little sick bag there. So yeah, that's my first one. It was kind of not quite what I'd expected, but equally well, was quite interesting, really. I thought, yeah, actually, I could do this.
So what year did you join the RAF?
I joined the RAF in 1978, and I was a university cadet, and basically that meant that they paid for me to go to university, paid me while I was at university, taught me to fly in the university air squadron while I was there for 3 years, and then at the end of it I was kind of automatically inducted into the RAF, into the full training system, as if I'd kind of joined from straight away, as it were.
And did you have a type you wanted to fly on?
Yeah, I actually wanted to fly Phantoms, which is something that I wouldn't want to admit to people like Dave Gledel and people like that. But yeah, that was the thing that really took. I wanted to be a Phantom pilot. And actually, I'd been through basic flying training at Cranwell, there was a hold-up in the training system, and we were told to go and lose ourselves for 3 months, where it was. And I was sent out to Gütersloh, and I was there as the station flight safety officer, and I shared an office with this guy called Bruce Cogram, I think it was, and he was Mr. Harrier, and day one started with him saying, right, okay, so what do you want to fly? And I said, I want to fly Phantom, sir. And there was the old kind of, I could see what's being crossed off the Christmas card list as he went, oh, loser. But yeah, that was it. That's what I wanted to fly. And it really wasn't until I got to the tactical weapons unit where I'd sort of realised that my ability to really lay it kind of in the low level world, and I really enjoyed flying at low level. I thought, actually, do you know what? I need to get to the mud moving world. Yeah, so having started in 78 as a university cadet, I was kind of automatically enrolled in the university air squadron, and that involved lots of flying and not popping in for the occasional lecture. But actually, when I arrived, they said, right, you're now paid by the Air Force, you're paid to get a degree, so you will work, and you can fly once you've passed your exams in the first year. I wish I passed my exams, obviously, and then we had summer camp, and so I learnt to fly, because I'd learnt to fly the kind of 2 summers previously, because I had a flying scholarship. So back to the Air Force and to the Bulldog. And so I kind of learned to fly all over again on the Bulldog, which was, it was a lovely machine actually, because it was, as light aircraft go, it's tremendously powerful. I can't remember, I think it was about 230 horsepower, something like that, but it's quite a powerful machine. It used to go downwind at 100 knots. You could say, wow, that's really impressive. I spent 3 years kind of learning to fly the Bulldog, and that I got about just shy of 150 hours actually in 3 years, which is pretty good going really. And that took us all right from, you know, starting from, you know, effects of controls one right through. We did end up doing low level navigation and close formation, a bit of instrument flying as well, so it's kind of a bit of everything really. And having done that, that kind of qualified me for what was known as the short course at Cranwell on the Jet Provost when I got, so I had to go to initial officer training, which was kind of 18 weeks, a little bit longer for me, of having your brain removed and running around lots. And then you started flying on the Jet Provost. And that was the Jet Provost 5, which was quite a sort of swept up machine. It had quite a powerful engine. It had a pressurised canopy. And because the guys who went up to Yorkshire started on the Jet Provost 3, which is a kind of... a heap of donkey droppings, really, as far as I can work out. So we did what I was on the 5, and that was, it's basically the same thing, i.e. circuits and then into, you know, aerobatics and that kind of stuff, which we've done on the Bulldog, but you're doing it again in the JP, which is kind of faster, more powerful, a bit of low-level navigation, close formation, night flying, instrument flying, a bit of everything. The same thing, bigger aeroplane, goes faster, so all the numbers were bigger, but basically the same kind of stuff. And so I finished there in front end of 83. That's when I popped across to Goodesloe and upset the people there by saying I want to fly Phantoms instead of Harriers. And then I arrived at Valley to fly the Hawk in kind of September, October time, 83. And that was kind of where it all really kicked off for me, because I found the JP really hard work. I wasn't a natural. It was really hard. The airplane I found was to be a real pig, and I can't honestly say, hand on heart, that I enjoyed flying it or that I enjoyed the year that I spent at Cranwell flying it. But we pitched up at Valley and it's just completely different. I mean, I think the atmosphere space was different because Cranwell's kind of very sort of very stuffy and oldie worldy, but Valley was brilliant. It's just an amazing place. You got there and just the whole atmosphere, it was a real kind of, yeah, it was, you know, the fast jet thing. It was all kind of, you know, testosterone and kerosene and, you know, boys having a good time. And the Hawk was, it's just an amazing machine. It's like a sports car, really. It's the sports car of the skies. Again, the syllabus is pretty much the same. You did the same stuff. You got it. You flew around effects and controls, you know, stalling, spinning, aerobatics, low-level nav, close formation, all the same old stuff. But in the Hawk, where everything just seemed to come very, very naturally to me, or much more naturally, shall I say. And it was a real pleasure. And so at the end of that course was when we were given our wings. So I graduated in Feb 84 on 96 Hawk course, and got my wings from Sir Michael Beetham. Felt very proud of myself. Then there was a little bit of a hold up in the system because there were so many guys going through training, and this was a time, remember, when the tornado was coming in, so they needed loads and loads of pilots, so the machine was kind of, the sausage machine was full on pumping people out, but they kind of weren't quite the sort, so they had to wait for, in fact it was about 6 months I think. So I did a quick refresher at Valley, then I arrived at Chivna for the tactical weapons unit, and that was kind of where, you know, I'd started in 78, flown the Bulldog, flown the JP, flown the Hawk, all red and white aeroplanes, all doing pretty much the same kind of thing one after the other. Suddenly we arrived at, back end of 84, completely different. Arrive, the aeroplanes are painted in camouflage, which is quite sort of different, you know, so psychologically you go, wow. But the syllabus was completely different, and it was taken as red, you could fire the machine. But now we're into, you know, instead of going effective controls and stalling, we're into, right, close formation, battle formation, air combat. And that was kind of mind-blowing, really, for a number of reasons. Firstly, because you had one look and then one go, and then you moved on to something else. So you never really had time to kind of get competent or feel comfortable. You kind of just moving on all the time. And the learning curve was kind of massively steep. But things like, here's stupid things. So close formation did in the Hawk, you know, it's, you know, right next to your next guy, lining up with the references, so you're really close in there. Battle formation, you're actually, in the Hawk, you're 2 kilometres, a mile apart, flying sort of line abreast, and that sounds all right, but if the other airplane is really well camouflaged, then you can't see it. So that's the first problem, is can't see it. And the other thing is that if you're going along in line abreast, and for example, you want to turn over there, if people just go like that, suddenly you're out of formation. So the way that you sorted out was you did this crossover. So you, and a couple of the stories start with a chivalry, you start off and you do a right turn. And the way you turned was you both turned towards each other, cross over, and then turn back again to roll out. And so you had to basically know who was going to avoid who, because obviously you don't want to hit each other, because you point at each other. And then you also, the airplanes, when we went through Valley, had this thing called AHARS, which is a really good gyro compass system. The ones at Hawk were pre-AHARS, sorry, at Chivna were pre-AHARS. And so every time you went to a hard turn, because all the turns were like 4G, the compass just carried on spinning, so you couldn't actually, so if you tried to roll out on the compass, you couldn't, so you had to go in and you before you turned, you'd look, you know, I need to point at that over there, so you then whack across to your mate, avoid him, or he'd avoid you, whichever it was, and then you turn back again and point towards wherever it was, and then roll out and try and look at this airplane that you couldn't see because it was camouflaged. That was the kind of low level navigation battle formation. We got into air combat, which was that's the sport of kings. It's brilliant. Imagine going off with your mate in another airplane, and then you point away and you point at each other. The next thing is you've got to try and get on your mate's tail, and it was the sport of kings. It was just so much fun, really, really fun. And it's actually, that was the one thing that I was any good at all the way through flying training. I could do that. And from there we went to weaponry, and again that is a massive. Although we'd obviously joined the Air Force and it was military, kind of we'd flown red and white aeroplanes up to then and done, it's been academic learning how to fly. But suddenly when you tell, right, point pink body towards the ground and fire a gun or drop a bomb, I mean, it is just amazingly, A, exciting, B, quite frightening, and C, kind of puts everything together, kind of realise what you've just spent the last so many years learning how to do. So that was a kind of really sort of moment where you go, gee, this is what we're here for. But again, you kind of got one go at it, one show, one go, off you go, right, have a go yourself, that's it, next, and on to the next thing. And the whole thing wound up to what's called the SAP phase, which is similar to attack profile. And you ended up, the last one, you ended up leading a pair that was bounced, so you had somebody going trying to shoot you down while you went off, and you had to run, you did a first run attack at the range. I think it was timed as well, so you had to, you know, get airborne on the right time, and you know, you watched it again, trying to kill out, and then you had to get off while your mate was trying to stop you, and drop a bomb, and then you went off and you attacked, I think, 2 different targets out in your bridges or something out in the middle of Wales, while this other aeroplane was trying to stop you doing it. And that was the end of this frenzied sort of, I don't know, 4 months or whatever it was at Chivna, at the end of which they then decided where you're going to go to next. And there were various kind of, obviously the great thing if you're a pilot is to do it yourself, and a single seat, don't need a navigator. The Harrier was the kind of top thing, and basically the top guys went there, but you did have to be shit hot to go to the Harrier. Not a Lieutenant Harrier pilot, that, obviously. Because it was a very, very difficult aeroplane to fly, and because it didn't have very much kit, so really you were the sort of the computer, if you like. So you had to be really on top of your game there. Jaguar, again, quite a tricky aeroplane to fly, and you're on your own. And then you were into Tornado and Phantom at that stage. Two guys, Phantom quite difficult to fly, but relatively in terms of the job a little bit straight, more a little bit easier, I suppose. Although Phantom pilots would probably disagree. Tornado, ground attack, flying close to the ground, all that kind of stuff, and kind of needing you to be pretty much on the ball. So, and actually, although I'd obviously wanted to fly the Phantom all the way through training, actually what I discovered was that I really enjoyed the low-level environment. I really enjoyed the kind of low-level attack thing. So I decided actually really what I wanted to do was to fly the Tornado. I should actually point out here that I was not terribly good at flying in circuits and the rest of it, and the Phantom is quite a handful. So I think had I gone to the Phantom, I probably would have found it quite difficult actually, because it was, I gathered, quite a handful in the circuit, whereas Tornado is actually pretty straightforward really. But yeah, at the end of that, I was sectioned to the Tornado.
Michael talks about his squadrons, bases, and his roles within the RAF.
Yeah, well, so I arrived at Bruggen which at that stage had a wing of three squadrons of Tornado GL1. It was about to come four. The other squadron came, was nine squadron, which came out from Honington in, I think, about 86, back end of 86, I think. But for the moment, there were just three squadrons there. And we were the kind of the front line, as we saw it, of the RAF in Germany. There were three strike attack squadrons up at Larbrook, flying Tornado G1, and three strike attack squadrons at Bruggen. Strike attack meaning a strike is, that's nuclear stuff, so that was our prime role, was nuclear strike. And the aeroplanes were there ready to go, so we had guys on QRA, strike loaded aeroplanes, and they were part of the NATO kind of I'm lost for words for a moment, but part of our answer to the Warsaw Pact, and so our role for that was that was the first thing we had to meet, was whatever the SACEUR, Supreme Allied Command of Europe, said how many strike aeroplanes he needed, we had to provide those, and anything that was left over was then available for attack operations. In terms of wartime stuff, we were tasked with attacking the Soviet Air Force airfields in eastern Germany. So all of those with good old JP-233, and also the strategic SAM sites, SAM-5 sites in east Germany. So we were to take those out in the case of war. And really, our time in Germany, apart from the exercises, which went on and on, couple of times a month, the sirens would go off at 2 o'clock in the morning, you're racing to work, and the guys at Curry would come to combat to combat readiness, ready to go. So apart from the outside that, our routine training was basically kind of attack training, fly off as a pair, fly around Germany, and we'd do simulated attacks on a couple of targets. We'd go to the various ranges that were around. So we had Nordhorn range was the prime one, which was up sort of kind of north of Larbrook. There was one Vliehorst, which was out on the Dutch coast. There was Pampa range, which is in Holland, which wasn't very far away. We didn't get it very often, but that was easy actually, because he got there. And there was, to step back, Nordhorn range was kind of in the middle of nowhere. So you pitched up, and luckily, because we had a moving map display on, so you could follow it, go eat. And the initial point for the attack was, it was a minor road junction. It was funny, a minor road junction in Germany. I mean, there are millions of them. But there, so you found this road junction, off you went, and there was a target to attack. Vliehorst, which was on the Dutch coast, you started off at this huge a causeway across the top of the kind of what we call the Zuider Zee, where it's called now, IJsselmeer, and you set off and you're just heading towards the tip of this island that was kind of very, very, very low, and the target was there. But if you went to Pampas Range, it was Helchstrand actually, it was called, and there was this massive great lead in all the way along, and the target was huge, great yellow board that you couldn't possibly miss, and it was brilliant. So you go there if you want to get the range scores up, right, go to Pampas, around you went. So that was brilliant. There was also actually a range down at Siegenberg, down in southern Germany, just south of Nuremberg, and occasionally we get slots on that. And again, that was great. In fact, it was great because the range safety officers there were American Air Force guys who were sent there for a week, and they were pilots or navigators, so they were quite generous with the scoring. Actually, they go, yeah, it's good enough, direct hit. and again, because that was a little bit higher, there were various. The other ranges were all kind of at sea level, but that was actually a couple of thousand feet, I think, and that had quite a big effect because you had to be really correct in terms of the height sensor that you used to tell the bomb how high it was before it went off. Because if it's at sea level, you can just use a radar altimeter and that tells you. But obviously, if you're a little bit higher off, you have to get it exactly right. So that's a bit of a challenge, really. And that was it, really. So we flew around Germany. Germany was, at that stage, it was full of, the army, so there are no end of targets available. There was tanks deployed, there were bridges being built across the Weser at Hameln. There was guys on exercise. There were SAM sites. There was all sorts of stuff. So when you came in the morning, you go, right, we're going to find two targets. There was no problem at all finding that. And similarly, the airplane or the sky was just full of airplanes. All the guys from Wildenroth down there, the Phantom guys would launch off, and they'd put caps up all over the place. There'd be F-16s out, there'd be F-15s out from Susterberg and the rest of it. So when you went out into Germany, it was the airplane the skies were full of airplanes. So we'd do our attacks and we'd find out where the fighters are going to be and whistle through their caps, their combat air patrols, and do a bit of affiliation with them. So yeah, and then go to the range. So it's kind of full on, really. It was great fun. Yeah, an hour and three quarters worth of rushing around Germany, hair on fire. That's why we've got none left.
Here, Michael talks about flying the Tornado GR1.
The Tornado, it was a massive step up from the Hawk. The Hawk was actually very, very simple. The Hawk's a bit like a glove that you kind of put on, and the Tornado was actually bigger. But when you sat in it, it was quite a comfy, roomy cockpit, and everything was kind of where you kind of wanted it to be. Throttles on the left hand side, outboard of that your flap lever, and just inboard a wing sweep lever. Most of the stuff on the right hand side on the console down there was stuff that you probably didn't need to do an awful lot with, sort of air conditioning and that sort of stuff. But in front, the whole thing was kind of dominated by, there was a big circular moving map display which showed you where you were or where the airplane thought you were, and above it, and you kind of looked right the way through it onto the windscreen, was the head-up display, which had all the flying instruments that you needed, and that's actually the prime kind of instrument flying, those are the prime flying instruments. There were actually sort of traditional ones down on the right hand side of that under the combing, and on the left hand side that's where you had the engine instruments. But everything's where you want it. But it was very easy, kind of like a nodding dog, really, just looking between the HUD and the moving map. Where am I? Rather than actually looking out. The airplane itself, once you got your mind around its complexity, was actually very straightforward to fly. I say that having found it quite difficult to start with, but kind of eventually I got used to it and got to know and got it to work properly for me. But it was a very straightforward airplane flight. It was a kind of, it had a fly-by-wire system, so the clever electronics took out all the kind of difficult handling characteristics. In the circuit, you put the wings forward, it flew like a straight-wing aeroplane, so you didn't have any of the buffets and all that kind of stuff that you might have in a Phantom or a Lightning or something like that. So it was very, very straightforward. And once you got airborne, you cruising speeds of sort of 420 knots, you'd be the wing halfway back in 45 wing. And again, the electronics kind of took out any peculiarity. It flew like a kind of like a big Hawk, really, in some respects. But with all the drag underneath it, it was much heavier in the controls. But it was kind of quite easy to fly. Quite pleasant to fly, very comfortable to fly. I mean, at a low level, the Hawk would bounce around, but the Tornado just stuck there. Quite a high wing loading, so you'd be very comfortable flying at low level for long distances, and you whistle through the mountains, and that'd be bounced. Well, if you would be bounced around in a Hawk, in the Tornado, you just cut straight through it. It was a very kind of stable aeroplane, very, very comfortable. Reasonably manoeuvrable, actually, for its day. And again, there was a in 45. There was a thing called manoeuvre flap, which was just on the throttle. Actually, you kind of just blipped your thumb down, that gave you manoeuvre flap. So in 45, we just gave you slat, which kind of turned well. Once you got speed below about sort of 360, 300 knots around about there, you pop the wings forward, and then again, the manoeuvre flap would give you flap as well, and it turned pretty well. And certainly, you'd outturn a Phantom. So that kind of thing in Germany, you whistle around. You find a Villeneuve Phantom and sneak behind him. And then you knew he couldn't get away from you because you could turn better than he could. The only problem is that the Germans had F4Fs, I think it was, which had slats on, which turned even better. So if you got settled on the German, you go, oh dear me, trying to bug out. It was a very pleasant environment, actually, and it was, I would say, it was virtually vice-free. The thing about it was that on the Hawk, for example, being straight in the airplane, when you're manoeuvring, particularly kind of air combat and that kind of stuff, you'd want to manoeuvre right on the edge of the stall, so you'd get this buffet, so you just sit there and really light buffet, and you could, the wing would kind of talk to you, if you like. So if you pull a bit harder, you get a bit more fit, you're pulling too much, so you just relax a bit. The Tornado had no buffet. So there was nothing, and all you actually had was, just next to the HUD there was an alpha gauge which told you how much, what your angle of attack was, and there was a limit on it, and I think it's 21 alpha, and if you went above that then you might depart the aeroplane, but there was no warning. So the only thing was you had to look and see what the alpha gauge was reading, so there was no feedback at all. There was a thing fitted called SPILS, which was the spin prevention and instrument incident limitation system, which if the advertising standards agency had anything to do with, they would have banned it because it did neither of those things. Because I know various people who had departed the aeroplane with the spills on. In fact, I myself did on one occasion. There's an air combat sortie and we bugged out and we were kind of nose up, pushing out, and I was looking over my shoulder and I looked back and thought, right, I'll pitch back now, and I pulled the stick back, and as I pulled the stick back and right, yeah, I just felt the nose going left and I thought, that shouldn't be right. And yeah, in fact my nav at the back said, he said, yeah, first thing I knew something was wrong when you started saying, and it was the kind of mantra if you lost control, is control, centralised, height monitor, air brakes in and I started saying that and he went, ah, but at the airplane it came straight, yeah, as soon as I released it just came straight back. So, yeah, spills that may or may not have worked. But that was probably about the only vice that the aeroplane had, really. It was actually a really vice-free and user-friendly aeroplane, really. And everything was very... The view was pretty good from the front cockpit, less so from the back, because the nav sat right between the air intakes and they went out, so you couldn't see down. At low level, not a problem. Obviously, once you start going up to medium level, as we did out in the Gulf, then suddenly, you know, you can't see down beneath you, and that's where the threat is. But from the front seat, pretty good. The only thing was there was a massive, great big sort of combing that came up like that, and there were blind spots either side. And a couple of very good mates of mine got killed actually mid-air collision, and probably the aeroplane coming across was actually in that blind spot, which they just never saw it. So that's the kind of, you really have to move your head around. But yeah, it was actually a lovely aeroplane to fly, and I kind of flew it for almost 10 years, and I kind of really felt at home. And you know, towards the end, to start with, it was a bit, oh my god, what's happening? But yeah, towards the end, I really got to feel at home in it, and really enjoyed it, and really loved it as well. Yeah, it was a great machine. The Tornado cockpit was actually really well laid out. It's very ergonomic. As I mentioned earlier on to your left hand, you had the throttles, outboard of those a flap lever, inboard the wing sweep lever. Behind that was a thing called CSAS, which the Command Control Organisation, I can't even remember what it's called now, or what that stood for, but basically that was in round terms the fly-by-wire system. So that was the stick was actually connected not to pulleys and ropes, but actually to wigglies that went through this box. So that was all there in case you got any kind of failures or anything like that. Just ahead of that was actually the terrain following radar system, and that was a kind of, the thing about Tornado was that it was the first aeroplane that the RAF had ever had that had a low level all-weather capability, basically due to the fact that it had this terrain following radar. So the deal was that you would you'd switch this radar on if it was night or it was in bad weather. You'd then connect it to the autopilot using the little box of tricks down that was down by your left thigh. Later that got moved up to the combing, so it was easier to see. And then the aeroplane fly itself around on whatever route you put on, whatever they go, so it would fly around at whatever height you dialed in, 500 feet at night. Automatics, scary stuff. So that was kind of the left hand side of the cockpit. The right hand side, I think, as I mentioned earlier on, had air conditioning and various bits and pieces, fuel, etc., down that side as well. And then you had your flying instruments on the left hand side, the instruments on the right hand side, with the movement map display, the head-up display, and then kind of either side of those, just below the combing, there were two TV screens, and the left hand side was the e-scope, and that basically showed you what the terrain following radar was looking at. So if you were doing automatic terrain following, you'd go along from the front seat, you'd make sure that down here you had all the right buttons pressed, about three buttons that you had to press, so you'd check your three white lights there. You'd then look it up into the head of display, and there would be a little T displayed showing that the terrain following radar was on, and there'd be a flight directed dot, and you'd check that the aeroplane was actually the aeroplane symbol, the autopilot, actually flying following the terrain, the dot, and then you'd check the e-scope, and the e-scope was giving you like a sideways view of the terrain ahead. And the big thing that you were interested in on was if you had what we call cutoff. So if a radar's looking at something and there's like a blank space, it can't see beyond that. So it'll tell you there's something there, but it won't tell you what's beyond it, and that's kind of cut off. And so it was almost a continuous running commentary between the back seat and the front seat, what you could see. Because the guy in the back would have his ground mapping radar, And so I'd say, like, I've got cut off at, you know, 5 miles, and then I'd talk down, and then he'd say, he'd agree that he had cut off on his radar screen as well, and I'd be looking to see, there were a couple of lines on the e-scope which showed what, well, the kind of avoidance that the airplane had to take, and you'd confirm. I say, okay, it's climbing over the ridge, and then because he had a longer range radar that's kind of slightly looking down, would say, oh, I'm painting beyond now, so you knew that you're painting on the ridge, you could see what's going on, and then you kind of monitor the autopilot. So there's a continuous banter between two of you as you went on auto TF, say, checking, so he knew that the autopilot was in, that it's all flying flight director, what you were seeing on the e-scope, he then tell you what you see on the ground mapping radar, and so it going backwards and forwards, so that you both knew what was going on, because it was a great way of killing yourself if you didn't get it right. So, like all these things really, so there's a bit of an incentive there to do that. And again, because we were kind of working together really as a, you know, as hand in glove, as a really close-knit team, you both needed to know exactly what the other guy saw. Air to ground stuff, basically that was kind of run by the back seat, and you'd have a pre-planned target. The back seater would you'd plan your attack from initial point down to the target itself. You'd identify in the planning stage various kind of radar offsets that he'd probably be able to see on the radar. And if you could actually mark those on the radar, then that went back into the computer, and the computer, oh, hang on, you told me that that wood is X from the target. So if you say that's there, then the target must be there. So we kind of update the target position. So the backseater would kind of be there with his radar thing, trying to honing in on the radar position, so that when eventually you could see that, you know, when eventually that became clear, you'd be able to find the radar, the target itself on the radar. From the front seat, we do it on a map, so we were looking out the window, and we go, right, I'm going to see this wood after 70 seconds, I'm going to see that river, and so we'd be thumbing our way down the map, so we'd be kind of working our way down that way, they'd be working that way, and hopefully we'd meet at the far end with his radar mark sitting over the target for me to find. And again, if it was night, or if we're TFRing because it was bad weather, then we'd totally do that on the navigator's mark. Obviously, looking out the window, you can be a bit more accurate because you can see what's going on. So there's the option there of taking over from the front seat, saying, I've controlled this attack now, and marking it accurately for the computer to work out. So again, that was from the front seat. There was a kind of, it was like a sort of big banana that stuck here with a sort of Chinaman's hat on thing up, so you could actually once you saw where the target was, you could take control in the front seat and then move it around. And then there was a final mode worthy of note, which is called target opportunity. So if you're China and you suddenly saw a lot of tanks up front, you go, target opportunity, and there was a button that you pressed at the front, and that then armed all the bombs or whatever he'd set in the back. But again, it gave you air-to-ground weapon aiming picture in the head-up display, so again, you could... it gave you basically a line showing where the bomb would fall, and a little sort of marker showing, right, if you press the bombs now, they'll land here, and you waited so that motored up through where it was the target, on this side, dunk, on the stick top, and you could drop weapons that way. Guns, again, there was a air-to-ground gun switch, which gave you an air-to-ground gun picture, which was kind of like, it gave you a fixed cross to show you where the airplane's pointing, it gave you a pipa to show where the shells would land, and then a range ring around it. And as you came in, you'd put the pipa on the target and wait for the range to come around. Ranging was either through the radar from the back seat, or there's a laser as well, so either of those, and then you could then the firing it was off a trigger on the top of the stick top. So and as I say, it was actually pretty well designed cockpit, really. It was comfy, it was big, and things were pretty much where you wanted them to be, so it was good.
And finally, we get a personal side to Michael himself.
So Michael, you're also a Polish author, like, tell me about that.
Yeah, well, I should actually, I'm going to point out Exhibit A here, which, if I can just put that there, this is my first ever book, which is, it's a book about Dusseldorf Flughafen, and I reckon this is probably almost 50 years old, actually. Very fantastic drawings in here. So that's kind of where it all started. And I first got into the idea of writing a book, because I wrote up the history of 14 Squadron, which is a particularly fine squadron, and what I realised, because it had been out in the Middle East for most of its time and then out in Germany, is nobody ever written it down. So that's how I got into the kind of book writing thing. I did a 2-volume history of that. And off the back of that, I'd written, I ended up busting an Achilles tendon about 15 years ago now. playing squash, silly thing to do. And I, well, I had nothing to do, I stuck my leg up a bit plaster. I thought I'd write a few things. I'd kind of through my time in the Air Force, I'd written a few things down, I kept some diaries, I'd written accounts of things, and I pulled all that together and into a book which nobody wanted to publish called Tornado of the Tigris. And then having published, they said, oh yeah, that's really interesting. So that was this one here, which is Tornado of the Tigris, and that it's basically kind of the story of, you know, a little boy wanting to fly airplanes who eventually gets to fly tornadoes, and the experience of flying tornadoes in Germany, almost 10 years worth of flying, a bit of time on the Hawk that I did as well as a tactics instructor, where there's some fantastic flying, and covering really kind of the end of the Cold War out in Germany. And then actually, I was instructing at the time at Chibnall Flying the Hawk, having a great time when my mates were fighting a war over in Iraq. And but afterwards, of course, things carried on for quite a long while with no fly zones or anything. I was involved in that, and also while we were there, we were invited to go and show the Iraqis who was boss a couple of times, and so I was involved in a couple of missions there as well. And so kind of that all that's covered in that particular book, which which tells the story. And what I tried to do with it really was to, you know, when I look back on some of the books that I read, and I think of Stranger to the Ground by Richard Bach, I think about F4 Phantom Pilots by Rob Press, those books that kind of put you there. And what I wanted to try was to capture the essence of what was it like to fly a tornado, what was it like to fly at low level, what was it like to, you know, go fly over Iraq, and that, or, you know, what was it like to flash around in the Hawk and have loads of fun while your mates are fighting a war. And that's kind of what I put in there. So I kind of hope that, you know, if someone wants to know what that was like, the book's there, and it'll kind of, you know, read it and you can live it. You know, it is, you know, hopefully it takes you there. So that's where that came from. And I, the editor that I worked with on that said, well, Mike, have you thought about, you know, someone else a bit, you know, and how about, and we thought about it, and the airplane that's really quite fascinating was the Gloucester Javelin. And I can now show you Exhibit C, which is this one here, Gloucester Javelin. And you can buy books about the Javelin, and they tell you how it was designed, how it was test flown. They'll talk about what colour it was, where it might have gone, because it was an airplane that was there was a lot of kind of potential for development, which was never quite realised. But there's about two pages in each of these saying, and by the way, the RAF flew them for 10 years, and then nothing else. And my thought was, well, what did the guys do with this aeroplane? And what could I put in? And kind of, I thought really, having flown kind of fast jet myself, the bit that I could put in is the operational side of it. You know, what was it like to fly? What did the guys do with it? And I met some fascinating guys. I had virtually a whole day with Sir Freddie Sowery, who commanded 46 Squadron in 1959, you know, before I was born. What was it like to be a Javelin Squadron Commander in those days? Yeah, amazing guy, really fascinating chap. I mean, he went on to be an Air Marshal. In fact, he wrote the foreword for me. I had a fantastic... I spent lunch talking to Sir Richard Johns, who was Chief of the Air Staff, whom I remembered as Station Commander when I was at my little brief visit to Goodesloe, when I upset everybody saying I wanted to fly Phantoms. Again, he'd flown his first tour as a Javelin pilot, and again, talking to him about it was just fascinating. And this aeroplane, which was kind of the usual kind of crappy, you know, British design, was actually, at the time, was cutting-edge technology, was cutting-edge in terms of operation capability, and it was the first aeroplane the RAF had that had missiles on it. It was the first tactical aeroplane the aeroplanes had that the RAF had air-to-air refueling. And they did all this amazing stuff of, right, we're going, how does one get a squadron to Singapore? So they kind of worked it all out. They sent, you know, well, first, we'll start off by sending half a squadron halfway there, and then we'll send all, you know, and all the sort of goings that went on with that. An amazing sort of, while at the same time kind of manning the front line of the Cold War in the air defence world. And, well, how do we deal with jamming, and how do we do this? And they're out in Germany as well. Well, how do you? And then the airplanes were in Cyprus, big problem in Rhodesia. Send the guys off to off to Zambia. They're interesting stuff. Out in Singapore, the confrontation with Indonesia, and so the squadron there suddenly found themselves on a 1,000-mile frontage, trying to sort of defend it all. And again, talking to Mike Miller, who was one of the squadron bosses at the time, it was fascinating talking to him. You know, how they kind of got around all this and operating over Borneo, been shot at by the Indonesian troops. So you know, there's some fantastic stuff there, and it's a fascinating aeroplane. But what the guys got up to is absolutely amazing, and that's kind of what I tried tried to instill and capture in that book as well. So yeah, that's where I'm at with the book writing. I've just started. I'm writing an operational history of the Tornado GR1, a subject very close to my heart. But one of the fascinating things for me is actually, as I mentioned, I didn't fight in the Gulf War. I was instructing in Chiffin at the time, but the guys who did them are very proud of what they did, obviously. And I'm able to get all the stuff from the three bases at Dharan, at Tobruk and Bahrain, and kind of fit that together for the whole picture of exactly what all the guys did together. And later on, you know, what the Tornado Force did over Kosovo, where they were getting airborne from Bruggen, they were flying all these massively long sorties down air to air refueling over France, going over Italy, air to air refueling, then going out over Kosovo, then coming back again, operating from their home base. So they get home, then the wife would say, "Well, you're late, you know, you're supposed to pick up the kids at 4:30, but you know, I've been bombing the Kosovo, dear, whatever," and all that stuff. Again, you know, that's what I'm looking at the moment. So I'm in the process of doing that, and there'll be some fantastic stories and photographs and God knows what else, and stuff that, you know, hasn't been put together before, which again I hope will tell the story of what a wonderful airplane the Tornado was, but also what a wonderful bunch of mates used to fly it, because there were some really top guys. No, I mean, the only one I've been to recently, probably about almost 20 years. So I went to Riyadh, and I think it was the year before last, which it was interesting. I did find it a bit strange in a way, probably from being slightly dislocated away from military flying now. I did find it almost quite difficult, really, to be there and see or feel not part of it. But I suppose also because the things have kind of been toned down quite. There aren't as many military airplanes, there aren't as many kind of air shows as there once were. But the thing that really struck me on that one was that watching some bloke it was an Italian transport airplane doing aerobatics in this thing. It was a twin engine transport airplane, thinking, what's he doing now? And it was small, it's very, very impressive, but yeah, that was probably the most impressive bit, really. I've got the stage now, being a bit of a crusty old git now, where stuff gets airborne. I was just thinking, that's too loud, which is, yeah, not really the way things ought to be, really. So perhaps I'll need to, yeah, stand away and watch it from the distance or something.
If you could have flown anything else while you were a pilot, what would it have been?
Any airplane that you fly as a pilot is the best airplane in the world, particularly as a fast jet pilot. So from my perspective, obviously, the Tornado GR1 is the best airplane in the world. But yeah, if I could fly anything else, it would be the F-15E Strike Eagle, because that was just an amazing machine. And when we were in Dharan operating with them, it was just amazing to see this aeroplane. The thing that impressed me was it was kind of set up like that. You drive past them and they go, the left hand side of the aeroplane is air to ground and the right hand side is air to air. And this aeroplane could actually, it could look after itself, it could take names and kick ass. And that was, I kind of think, the weakness in the Tornado GL1. It didn't have a really decent, credible air to air capability. Okay, we carried the A9L, which had a head-on capability, but in terms of, when you think back to the RAF of the 1970s flying, you know, Phantoms in the air-to-ground mode, or air-to-ground role with Sparrow air-to-air missiles and a decent air-to-air, you know, PD radar, you think, what could the Tornado have been if it had that capability, you know, some sort of, you know, radar, air-to-air radar, and some means of slaving whatever missile you've got to that would be amazing. And the F-15 that got it all, and it got this amazing performance as well, which, you know, particularly high level. I don't know what it's like at low level. It's probably pretty good, because I suppose they load it up with so much kit, but the Tornado was rock solid. Whether the F-15E is or not, I don't know, but I'd love to find out. Or love to have found out. Probably a bit too often now, but there you go.
Now, we have a couple of fan questions for you.
Okay.
And they're quite geeky.
Excellent. So,
what was the fastest speed you ever reached?
I think it's probably just over 600 odd knots. One has to be quite pedantic here, because do you talk about airspeed, and if so, is that indicated airspeed or true and all the rest of it? But in terms of, yeah, proper speed, I'd say probably over the ground, probably just over 600 odd knots. And that was at Goose Bay, and it was one year we were there, doing our bits and pieces, and one of the ground crew spotted that there were cracks on some of the wing pylons. Immediate panic, ground the airplanes, stop flying. And our squadron boss at the time said, hang on a minute, well, let's just take the pylons off. So we took the pylons off. And then one of the other guys looked in the release service and looked at it and went, well, hang on a minute, all the restrictions we had were dependent on all the pylons and the tanks and everything else that we had. Suddenly we clean airplane and you turn over to page dunk at the back and suddenly all the speed's like, oh look, 700 knots, whatever it is. So, and actually what happened was we used to do a lot of affiliation with the Dutch guys, F-16 guys there, and there we, and it, you know, it was really easy for them because they're guys, a good, you know, it was fantastic over the F-16, fantastic area. But kind of, we'd work out so that we would get the training, we'd find out where they would be, and then we'd come through and we'd tell them we'd be at a certain time, we'd tell them where we're coming from, the rest of it, and they used to, you know, get, so they go, yeah, the Brits are coming, and they'd see us coming, go, oh yeah, shoot you, and it's all kind of, it was a bit easy, but we kind of, you know, we'd kind of tied our own hands behind our backs. So suddenly we got to say, we didn't tell them this time. So they reorganised it and off we went. And they were expecting us at 420 knots. We're actually going at 600. So they went, and, oh, okay, we're doing Brits. And then they ran. We'd gone. And we were gone past them. And in fact, when we came back again, yeah, again, they were still kind of trying to look for us over there. And we came up behind them a couple of shots away. And yeah, they wound their necks in. But yeah, the airplane, again, you mentioned about wing sweep, and at that speed, 67 wing, because it was clean, it was like a big hawk. It was, yeah, it was really responsive, and it was kind of where it wanted to be. It was, yeah, it was happy as Larry, and it turned well, and it was a real pleasure to fly it, actually, in a way that you kind of weren't used to, having flown it laden with all this stuff. Yeah, it was good fun.
So, do you prefer being a pilot or an author?
I think the one comes from the other, in that I don't think that, since what I write about is flying, and both in my own experiences that come in Tornado the Tigris, and through the experience of that, being able to talk to, for example, kind of Javelin aircrew in their language, you know, I couldn't have been an author if I hadn't been a pilot, if you know what I mean. Yeah, if I had to, I mean, now I like the idea of being an author. Now I like the idea that perhaps that's where a future lies. But it is very much based on the fact of having been a pilot or being a pilot. And actually, yeah, if I had to choose, it would, every time, I'm afraid, it would be, yeah, fly airplanes. Sadly, I still haven't grown up. I'm still a little boy who hasn't grown up yet.
Thanks very much for listening. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode. And if you want to watch Michael's or anybody else's interview, you can visit us at youtube.com/aircrewinterview. Thank you.